Chapter 9. I said, "Why, my darling, baby always sleeps like a graven image. I know, but there's something peculiar about his sleep now. He seems to breathe so regularly. Oh, this is dreadful. But, my dear, he always breathes regularly. Oh, I know it, but there's something frightful about it now. His nurse is too young and inexperienced. Maria shall stay there with her, and be on hand if anything happens. That is a good idea, but who will help you? You can help me all I want. I wouldn't allow anybody to do anything but myself, anyhow, at such a time as this." I said I would feel mean to lie abed and sleep, and leave her to watch, and toil over our little patient all the weary night. But she reconciled me to it. So old Maria departed, and took up her ancient quarters in the nursery. Penelope coughed twice in her sleep. "Oh, why don't that doctor come? Mortimer, this room is too warm. This room is certainly too warm. Turn off the register quick." I shut it off, glancing at the thermometer at the same time, and wondering to myself if 70 was too warm for a sick child. The coachman arrived from downtown now with the news that our physician was ill and confined to his bed. Mrs. McWilliams turned a dead eye upon me and said in a dead voice, "There is a providence in it. It is foreordained. He never was sick before. Never. We have not been living as we ought to live, Mortimer. Time and time again I have told you so. Now you see the result. Our child will never get well. Be thankful if you can forgive yourself. I never can forgive myself." I said, without intent to hurt, but with heedless choice of words, that I could not see that we had been living such an abandoned life. "Mortimer, do you want to bring the judgment upon baby too?" Then she began to cry, but suddenly exclaimed, "The doctor must have sent medicines." I said, "Certainly. They are here. I was only waiting for you to give me a chance." "Well, do give them to me. Don't you know that every moment is precious now? But what was the use in sending medicines, when he knows that the disease is incurable?" I said that, while there was life, there was hope. "Hope? Mortimer, you know no more what you are talking about than the child unborn. If you would, as I live, the directions say give one teaspoonful once an hour. Once an hour. As if we had a whole year before us to save the child in. Mortimer, please hurry. Give the poor perishing thing a tablespoonful, and try to be quick. Why, my dear, a tablespoonful might, don't drive me frantic. There, my precious, my own. It's nasty bitter stuff, but it's good for Nelly, good for mother's precious darling, and it will make her well. There, put the little head on mama's breast, and go to sleep, and pretty soon, oh, I know she can't live till morning. Mortimer, a tablespoonful every half hour will, oh, the child needs belladonna too, I know she does, and aconite. Get them, Mortimer. Now do let me have my way. You know nothing about these things." We now went to bed, placing the crib close to my wife's pillow. All this turmoil had worn upon me, and within 2 minutes I was something more than half asleep. Mrs. McWilliams roused me. "Darling, is that register turned on?" "No." "I thought as much. Please turn it on at once. This room is cold." I turned it on, and presently fell asleep again. I was aroused once more. "Dearie, would you mind moving the crib to your side of the bed? It is nearer the register." I moved it, but had a collision with the rug, and woke up the child. I dozed off once more, while my wife quieted the sufferer. But in a little while these words came murmuring remotely through the fog of my drowsiness. "Mortimer, if we only had some goose grease, will you ring?" I climbed dreamily out, and stepped on a cat, which responded with a protest, and would have got a convincing kick for it, if a chair had not got it instead. "Now, Mortimer, why do you want to turn up the gas and wake up the child again?" "Because I want to see how much I am hurt, Caroline." "Well, look at the chair, who I have no doubt it is ruined. Poor cat, suppose you add, now I am not going to suppose anything about the cat. It never would have occurred if Maria had been allowed to remain here and attend to these duties, which are in her line and are not in mine. Now, Mortimer, I should think you would be ashamed to make a remark like that. It is a pity if you cannot do the few little things I ask of you at such an awful time as this when our child... There, I will do anything you want. But I can't raise anybody with this bell. They're all gone to bed. Where is the goose grease? On the mantelpiece in the nursery. If you will step there and speak to Maria, I fetched the goose grease and went to sleep again. Once more I was called. Mortimer, I so hate to disturb you, but the room is still too cold for me to try to apply this stuff. Would you mind lighting the fire? It is all ready to touch a match to. I dragged myself out and lit the fire and then sat down disconsolate. Mortimer, don't sit there and catch your death of cold. Come to bed. As I was stepping in, she said, but wait a moment. Please give the child some more of the medicine. Which I did. It was a medicine which made a child more or less lively, so my wife made use of its waking interval to strip it and grease it all over with the goose oil. I was soon asleep once more, but once more I had to get up. Mortimer, I feel a draft. I feel it distinctly. There is nothing so bad for this disease as a draft. Please move the crib in front of the fire. I did it, and collided with the rug again, which I threw in the fire. Mrs. McWilliams sprang out of bed and rescued it, and we had some words. I had another trifling interval of sleep, and then got up, by request, and constructed a flaxseed poultice. This was placed upon the child's breast, and left there to do its healing work. A wood fire is not a permanent thing. I got up every 20 minutes and renewed ours, and this gave Mrs. McWilliams the opportunity to shorten the times of giving the medicines by 10 minutes, which was a great satisfaction to her. Now and then, between times, I reorganized the flaxseed poultices and applied sinapisms and other sorts of blisters where unoccupied places could be found upon the child. Well, toward morning the wood gave out, and my wife wanted me to go down cellar and get some more. I said, my dear, it is a laborious job, and the child must be nearly warm enough with her extra clothing. Now mightn't we put on another layer of poultices? And I did not finish, because I was interrupted. I lugged wood up from below for some little time, and then turned in, and fell to snoring as only a man can, whose strength is all gone, and whose soul is worn out. Just at broad daylight I felt a grip on my shoulder that brought me to my senses suddenly. My wife was glaring down upon me and gasping. As soon as she could command her tongue, she said, it is all over. All over. The child's perspiring. What shall we do? Mercy, how you terrify me. I don't know what we ought to do. Maybe if we scraped her and put her in the draft again. Oh, idiot. There is not a moment to lose. Go for the doctor. Go yourself. Tell him he must come, dead or alive. I dragged that poor sick man from his bed and brought him. He looked at the child and said she was not dying. This was joy unspeakable to me, but it made my wife as mad as if he had offered her a personal affront. Then he said the child's cough was only caused by some trifling irritation or other in the throat. At this I thought my wife had a mind to show him the door. Now the doctor said he would make the child cough harder and dislodge the trouble. So he gave her something that sent her into a spasm of coughing, and presently up came a little wood splinter or so. This child has no membranous croup, said he. He has been chewing a bit of pine shingle or something of the kind, and got some little slivers in her throat. They won't do her any hurt. No, said I can well believe that. Indeed, the turpentine that is in them is very good for certain sorts of diseases that are peculiar to children. My wife will tell you so. But she did not. She turned away in disdain and left the room, And since that time there is one episode in our life which we never refer to. Hence the tide of our days flows by in deep and untroubled serenity. Very few married men have such an experience as McWilliams, and so the author of this book thought that maybe the novelty of it would give it a passing interest to the reader. My first literary venture, I was a very smart child at the age of 13, an unusually smart child, I thought at the time. It was then that I did my first newspaper scribbling, and most unexpectedly to me, it stirred up a fine sensation in the community. It did, indeed, and I was very proud of it too. I was a printer's evil, and a progressive and aspiring one. My uncle had me on his paper, the Weekly Hannibal Journal, $2 a year in advance, 500 subscribers, and they paid in cordwood, cabbages, and unmarketable turnips, and on a lucky summer's day he left town, to be gone a week, and asked me if I thought I could edit one issue of the paper judiciously. Ah! Didn't I want to try? Higgins was the editor on the rival paper. He had lately been jilted, and one night a friend found an open note on the poor fellow's bed, in which he stated that he could not longer endure life, and had drowned himself in Bear Creek. The friend ran down there and discovered Higgins wading back to shore. He had concluded he wouldn't. The village was full of it for several days, but Higgins did not suspect it. I thought this was a fine opportunity. I wrote an elaborately wretched account of the whole matter, and then illustrated it with villainous cuts engraved on the bottoms of wooden type with a jackknife, one of them a picture of Higgins wading out into the creek in his shirt, with a lantern, sounding the depth of the water with a walking stick. I thought it was desperately funny, and was densely unconscious that there was any moral obliquity about such a publication. Being satisfied with this effort, I looked around for other worlds to conquer, and it struck me that it would make good, interesting matter to charge the editor of a neighboring country paper with a piece of gratuitous rascality, and he him squirm. I did it, putting the article into the form of a parody on the Uriel of Sir John Moore, and a pretty crude parody it was too. Then I lampooned two prominent citizens outrageously, not because they had done anything to deserve, but merely because I thought it was my duty to make the paper lively. Next I gently touched up the newest stranger, the lion of the day, the gorgeous journeyman tailor from Quincy. He was a simpering coxcomb of the first water, and the oddest dressed man in the state. He was an inveterate woman killer. Every week he wrote lushy entry for the journal about his newest conquest. His rhymes for my week were headed, "To marry an H.L.," meaning to marry an Hannibal, of course. But while setting up the piece I was suddenly riven from head to heel by what I regarded as a perfect thunderbolt of humor, and I compressed it into a snappy footnote at the bottom, thus : "We will let this thing pass, just this once. But we wish Mr. J. Gordon Runnels to understand distinctly that we have a character to sustain, and from this time forth, when he wants to commune with his friends in H.L., he must select some other medium than the columns of this journal." The paper came out, and I never knew any little thing attract so much attention as those playful trifles of mine. For once the Hannibal Journal was in demand, a novelty it had not experienced before. The whole town was stirred. Higgins dropped in with a double-barreled shotgun early in the forenoon. When he found that it was an infant, as he called me, that had done him the damage, he simply pulled my ears and went away, but he threw up his situation that night and left town for good. The tailor came with his goose and a pair of shears, but he despised me too, and departed for the south that night. The two lampooned citizens came with threats of libel, and went away incensed at my insignificance. The country editor pranced in with a war whoop next day, suffering for blood to drink, but he ended by forgiving me cordially, and inviting me down to the drugstore to wash away all animosity in a friendly bumper of Onstock's Vermifuge. It was his little joke. My uncle was very angry when he got back, unreasonably so, I thought, considering what an impetus I had given the paper, and considering also that gratitude for his preservation ought to have been uppermost in his mind, inasmuch as by his delay he had so wonderfully escaped dissection, tomahawking, libel, and getting his head shot off. But he softened when he looked at the accounts and saw that I had actually booked the unparalleled number of 33 new subscribers, and had the vegetables to show for it, cordwood, cabbage, beans, and unsalable turnips enough to run the family for 2 years. How the author was sold in Newark, written about 1869. It is seldom pleasant to tell on oneself, but sometimes it is a sort of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.